This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street all across North Dakota this Sunday morning. And this morning our show will feature humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson. He'll talk about his newest books, Repairing Jefferson's America, A Guide to Civility and Enlightened Citizenship, and Bring Out Your Dead, The Literature and History of Epidemics. Our in-depth discussion will follow this update from our news director, Dave Thompson.
The State Board of Higher Education has voted to submit a needs-based budget to Governor Burgum for consideration as he prepares his executive budget request for the 2021-2023 biennium. When Burgum issued his budget guidelines, higher education was asked to reduce its general fund request by 10%. That would come in a reduction in the higher ed's funding formula. That would drop the appropriation to $574.7 million. University System Vice Chancellor for Finance Tammy Dolan told the board that amount would actually be lower than the appropriation higher ed received in 2011-2013.
That's a significant drop in funding that would be extremely difficult for, if not impossible, for the institutions to manage.
University System Chancellor Mark Hagerot echoed that.
The fat is gone. They've leaned down. Now, with this shock, it's like we're going to start taking some muscle away.
The board is proposing a 1.1% increase in general fund spending. The budget includes an average 3% pay raise per year for all university system employees, and it allows for tuition to go up. The board has also okayed a proposed capital budget for the state's colleges and universities. It's an $80.7 million ask. Board member Kathy Nesset voted for the request, but sounded a cautionary note on both the capital request and the operational budget proposal.
We must remember that we are in a downturn in a state that is heavily supported by the oil industry. We are still looking at, you know, our production is way down. We've as many as 7,500 wells shut in. We have production tax, sales tax. We have so many taxes that are based on that. And I just want to put a reminder out there, just a reminder of realism and a realistic approach to this.
Board Chair Nick Hacker says the board might have to revisit things after the budget forecast comes out.
I would suspect those priorities will lean towards operating budgets versus capital budgets, which is traditionally the case.
The new forecast could be out by late August. And one of the included projects in the board's $80.7 million capital projects budget request is the Ag Products Development Center at NDSU. That's a $61 million project. The 2019 legislature okayed $60 million for the project. $40 million would come from bonds. NDSU would have to raise $20 million. Now, NDSU was asking the legislature for $21.2 million in lieu of fundraising. Board Chair Nick Hacker raised this question.
Did NDSU attempt to raise the dollars? Was there work that was done to try?
NDSU President Dean Brashani told the board a market study was done for the fundraising potential for that building.
It came back suggesting somewhere in the area of $6 million could be raised or had the potential to be raised. There were some people at the school who thought that it was to hold it off to the next legislative session, recognizing that it was an unreasonable amount of money to raise.
Brashani says the NDSU Foundation determined it could raise $6 million for the project, and board member Casey Ryan thought that should be taken into account. Brashani's response.
I think all the legislators are aware that we have successfully met the goal that we calculated was actually possible. We would absolutely bring that up again. So there's no effort to hide that the $6 million. And if the board chose to indicate that in your recommendations, I don't see any reason why not. It's well known and the appropriate circles already, so there's nothing to hide.
The board voted to keep the project on the book, minus the $6 million that NDSU has raised. And the board is giving University System Chancellor Mark Hagerot high marks. Board President Nick Hacker says Hagerot has been accessible and has been collaborative with college presidents. And Hacker singled out the way Hagerot and the system office have handled the COVID-19 crisis.
We greatly appreciated the chancellor pulling the right people together at the right times to launch task forces that allowed us to make what I believe the right decisions with the available information as COVID unwound.
The board voted to give Hagerot a 2.5% raise, but Hagerot told the board he would donate that amount, about $9,600 to the University System Foundation.
Because I'm just mindful, I'm paid a lot here, and most of my staff are well below the percentages they need to be.
Hagerot is paid $374,400. North Dakota's Information Technology Director says his department is using money from the CARES Act to purchase equipment as the state continues to move toward employees working remotely on a permanent basis. Telework expanded because of the COVID-19 pandemic. IT Director Sean Riley told the legislature's Interim Information Technology Committee his department is spending $10.5 million on new equipment.
We are purchasing a little over 6,000 devices, 6,000 laptops for across the state to be able to continue to enable telework and social distancing. Along with that, there's in the neighborhood of 9,000 monitors to be deployed. There's docking stations, hardware for cameras. We have new camera systems that are going into many of the conference rooms. So a huge amount of equipment that is exploding out across the state.
Riley also told the committee, though, there have been some problems getting all the needed gear delivered.
Unfortunately, there is still very much a supply chain problem worldwide. We cannot get the amounts of equipment that we need comprehensively yet.
Governor Burgum has said he will have some recommendations on some state employees continuing to work remotely even after the pandemic eases. And there was a bit of good economic news for the area. The Mid-American Business Conditions Index is now slightly above growth neutral for the nine-state region, which includes North Dakota. An index of 50 is neutral. The June index was 50.3. For North Dakota, it climbed to 51.6 from May's 43.4. Dr. Ernie Goss of Creighton University in Omaha publishes the monthly index. He says negative numbers are getting, as he put it, less negative.
Sort of crawling out of the recession, but we'll have to see a lot more months of above growth neutral numbers to be confident that we're actually moving back to something before pre-COVID-19 levels.
Goss says the surveys indicate a flattening out of employment with only slight gains over the months ahead.
We are seeing consumers getting out more. We're seeing businesses opening up more. We're seeing the leisure and hospitality, where this recession began, is opening up, but we've got a long, long way to go before we see a real opening of the regional economy and the North Dakota economy and the U.S. economy.
And Goss said the trade numbers are still pretty dismal, as are numbers for oil production and oil price. For Main Street Weekend, I'm Dave Thompson.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Clay Jenkinson is well known to public radio listeners as the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. He's also a prolific writer and the author of many books, including two that were published in June.
Well, I've been grounded. You know, I travel about 120 to 160 days per year, giving talks and presentations and leading cultural tours and so on. And since March 15th or so, I've been grounded. And I've taken advantage of that time to do some writing that I've been wanting to get done for a long time. And so the first of the two books will be out in a couple of weeks. It's called Repairing Jefferson's America. And the other one I actually wrote just in the last 5 weeks. I mean, it was almost an instant book. And I'm trying something new. I'm publishing it on Amazon Kindle because I wanted to get it out before the pandemic was over. I see I was a little premature in that. The pandemic shows no signs of ending. But I wanted to try Amazon Kindle, which is sort of an instant book system, just to see how that worked. And so that book, Bring Out Your Dead, the literature and history of pandemics, has been out for about 2 weeks.
Let's start with the first one, Repairing Jefferson's America, the full title, A Guide to Civility and Enlightened Citizenship. You've written about Jefferson before. Why did you want to write this book?
Well, Doug, you know, we all know that the country is in trouble. We're in disarray as a nation, and our congressional system is paralyzed. Nothing seems to be getting done. Carl Bernstein of Woodward and Bernstein has said that we're living through a cold civil war. There are at least two Americas. You know, there's coastal blue America and some cities in the interior. And then there's red America, the vast majority of the geography of the country. And the two sides have come to believe that the other one is not only wrongheaded, but really not American in the fullest sense of the term, that the other side is composed of people who are bringing down the American dream, people even accused of being treasonous. So how did this happen? How did we get to this point of paralysis? And is there a way out? So that's the basis of how I began to think about this. And I turned to my old friend Jefferson. Jefferson is, I think, the answer. But the problem with Jefferson is that he himself is now toxic, as you know, from all the attacks that have been leveled at him. A statue of Jefferson was torn down at a school in Portland recently. There's talk of removing his statue on the campus of Columbia University. His statues are vandalized even at the University of Virginia and at William and Mary. It's not clear that Jefferson will survive intact from this moment of racial retribution or racial comeuppance, however we want to discuss it. So I thought, if Jefferson himself is not any longer the answer, it's nevertheless the case that the Jeffersonian is the answer. Civility, majority rule, a commitment to reason, a belief in public education, a belief in progress, a belief that humans are basically good and capable of perfectibility through education and so on. Those ideas of living in a civil society where institutions check and balance each other and we move forward carefully through majority rule, and with a commitment to science and reason, that nexus of values, I think, is essential to American life, and nobody embodied it more or articulated it better than Thomas Jefferson. So the book is an attempt to distill from Jefferson's 83 volumes of writings a sense of what it would take for this country to get back on track and move towards greater harmony and majority rule. So that's the basis of it.
Are we in a revolutionary moment? I mean, this country was founded amid protest, and you and I remember other sort of revolutionary moments in the 20th century, the racial unrest, the Civil Rights Act, the Vietnam War, and the lingering effects of those things. Are we in a revolutionary moment now?
Hard to say, and time will tell. We're right in the midst of it, and so we can't know yet. You know, but we've seen these moments over the past 20 years where there's a shooting at a school, or a police shooting of an African-American, or a terrorist attack, or something of that sort, and then the country steps back, and there's this attempt at a conversation. What should we do about unrestricted distribution and ownership of guns? How can we protect our children in our schools from mayhem? How can we make sure that African Americans and other minorities are treated equally in the law and by our police forces and so on? So we face this from time to time. And normally, as you know, there's an intense brief conversation, and then it sort of peters out, and maybe there are a couple of attempts at reform, but we go back essentially to normal order, if you can call our order normal. And so there's a great disappointment in that after one of these massive school shootings, you think, well, maybe now we will really have a serious conversation about the place of the Second Amendment in an enlightened society. And then it doesn't happen. Well, this time, thanks to the extrajudicial killing of George Floyd in our neighboring state in Minneapolis, this has really touched off a very widespread movement that's showing no signs of letting up. And what's promising about this is that I think everyone, or almost everyone, gets it, that something has to be done, and it has to be done sooner rather than later, and rhetoric is not going to get us through this. And so we'll see. We'll see in the next months and years whether this is a turning point and reforms occur that really bring us closer to our ideal, that everyone is equal, or whether this is going to be another one of those moments, maybe more intense than the previous ones, after which the usual patterns reassert themselves and little, maybe nothing, is done to reform the culture. So I don't think we can know yet, but I think I have felt, and this is not a good historical tool, but I have felt that we're at a kind of a tipping point, and maybe we're going to wake up and say, oh, we thought we were farther along in enlightenment and justice than we are. These incidents reveal to us that we are still essentially a racist society, or there are strong racist elements, including structural racist elements in American life, and we're going to have to address that, or we aren't really the people we thought we were.
In your book, there are photographs of famous images of Jefferson. One is subtitled Exemplar of the Enlightenment, and of course, he lived in a different time. He was a slaveholder. He thought that white men were the people who should be in charge. He didn't care much for Native Americans, or didn't think much of them in the sense that they were the equal. They had their own nation, I guess, their own sovereignty, although that was easily threatened. So you've studied Jefferson for many years, and now you're trying to kind of separate the man from the ideals. How have your impressions of him changed?
Oh, my, that's a great question. You know, when I started thinking about Jefferson 30 or so years ago, he was riding very high, and he was sort of seen as America's Leonardo da Vinci, kind of a universal genius who dabbled in all sorts of different areas and distinguished himself in paleontology and library classification and architecture and statesmanship and in educational theory and on and on and on. And that was then. Things have really changed. And back then, he was seen as a kind of accidental slaveholder, that, you know, he was born into a world of slaves. He tried to wiggle his way out of it. He tried to reform the system and didn't succeed. And that eventually he, in a sense, had to shrug and say he wasn't going to get that great reform done in his own lifetime. And back then he was sort of given a pass that, oh yes, he was an owner of enslaved people, but he was a good man who would have freed the slaves if he had had the capacity to persuade his fellow Virginians. We now know that that was a myth, unfortunately, and that Jefferson is more complicit in slavery than we used to think. That he bought and sold slaves, that he had slaves tracked down, that when he had chances to take a leadership role in his retirement years to push for emancipation, he chose not to. He said he was too old and too tired, and that he eventually pushed for the extension of slavery into the American West, into the Louisiana Purchase Territory in Missouri, in the Missouri Compromise of 1819 and 1820. And by the end of his life, he had sort of been hardened into something approaching the Southern slave defender, defender of the institution. And so we now have a much different view. I think it's swung to the opposite extreme, so that now Jefferson is almost the poster child for hypocrisy of the Founding Fathers on this question. And I don't think that's quite fair either. But we certainly needed to make this corrective, that he wasn't a benevolent and accidental slaveholder. He was, in fact, a Southern slaveholder, and he, in spite of what he said, he perpetuated the institution of slavery and became increasingly complacent about it through the course of his life. So you can't realize this about someone you love, and I do love Thomas Jefferson, admire him, respect him, emulate him. You can't realize this without becoming disillusioned. And then you have to decide, all right, should he be removed from Mount Rushmore? Has he been discredited now as a contemptible hypocrite? Is he part of the problem rather than part of the solution? Should his statues come down? You know, these are hard and difficult questions. I say no to all of that. I think we still need Jefferson. But the book is an attempt to say, even if we give Jefferson a C- or a D- or an F on the question of African Americans, on the question of Native Americans, and even on the question of women's suffrage, if we give him poor marks on those things as a human being who lived between 1743 and 1826, we still need the Jeffersonian. We need the statement, all men are created equal. We need his belief in human progress. We need his belief that the rights tradition will continue to expand, that humans are up to the challenge of self-government, that we can educate ourselves to be good citizens. And his principles of separation of church and state, of due process, of the capacity of human beings to better their conditions, and, as the Enlightenment put it, to ameliorate the condition of mankind. we absolutely need that optimism, and we need that formula for social betterment and social change. And so it would be a terrible mistake, I think, to jettison all of Jefferson and the Jeffersonian just because he was so imperfect on his own personal behavior with respect to other races and respect to women.
Clay Jenkinson is a humanities scholar, the author of many books. We're talking about Repairing Jefferson's America, A Guide to Civility and Enlightened Citizenship. You referenced a very famous line from Jefferson, all men are created equal. And we need to remember that contemporaneously with Jefferson's life around the Revolutionary War, there were plenty of people who thought differently about some of these issues we still wrestle with, like slavery. Dr. Samuel Johnson said at the time of Jefferson, how is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty from the drivers of Negroes? Contextually, even, he lived in a time, John Adams, I think, was different about him on this particular issue. As we're bringing down statues, and you referenced that as well, I know that there's a Theodore Roosevelt statue at the New York Museum of Natural History that's coming down, or is being argued should come down, because there is an African-American and a Native American below him sitting on the horse. Should our public spaces and political history glorify so many privileged white males? I think that's one of the issues that's out there right now.
No, it should not. We're a multicultural democracy. We're not really a melting pot any longer. That metaphor is no longer really being used, but we represent people from every religion, every ethnic group, every continent, every nation, every tribal affiliation, every sensibility. And this is a great experiment. I mean, no other country has attempted to do quite what the United States has attempted to do. And so we're not Thomas Jefferson's nation anymore. He'd probably be horrified by much of what he saw in our time. But we don't need to try to remain the Founding Fathers' America. We need their principles. Some of their principles are universal principles. We need to look at them and reevaluate them and embrace them and insist on a higher standard of compliance with those standards. But we aren't the nation that Jefferson looked at in his own time. And so I think it's time for us to really face that as a nation. And I think we're having a very hard time facing it. And we need to remove many of the vestiges of a white supremacist view of American life. And so I think we need to be really careful about these statue removals and name changes and so on. And I would like to slow it down and make it more deliberate. I don't like mob action in Lafayette Park trying to pull down Andrew Jackson, or people showing up and plucking down a statue of Jefferson or George Washington in Portland, Oregon. I think that kind of mob action is not in a useful American style, although, as we all know, there's a streak of violence and anarchy at the core of American life. But I do think that many of these statues do need to go. And I for example, have written about the need to remove the Roosevelt statue. He's on a horseback. And below him, standing, are a nearly naked African gun bearer and a Native American, probably a Lakota. And it's clear that this is sort of Kipling-esque, the white man's burden, that Roosevelt is an exemplar of civilization, and these are two quote-unquote primitives, indigenous primitives, and Roosevelt is leading them into a future in which they will join civilization at some future point. And I know the statue was done as an act of respect to Roosevelt. It was done by one of the greatest American sculptors, James Earl Frazier. But it now is cringeworthy. And I've been cringing at it for about 20 years. When I first discovered it in visiting the American Museum, I thought, oh, this is not even Roosevelt as a naturalist. And that's what the American Museum of Natural History is about. But it also presents just one Roosevelt. And there are so many others. There's the man who set aside 234 million acres for public national parks and wildlife refuge areas and national forests and national monuments. There's the Roosevelt who was the trust buster and went after monopoly to try to make a square deal for all Americans. There's Roosevelt the progressive who was a suffragist and who also argued for a 40-hour week and to end child labor and to improve the industrial practices in our factories so that people wouldn't be maimed while doing honest work and so on. So there are so many Roosevelts. Not all of them are admirable by our standards, we assume that our standards are the right ones. And so I think that statute doesn't really represent the greatness and the breadth of Theodore Roosevelt, and I would say that it should come down. I hope they don't melt it down. I hope they put it in a museum room and interpret it there. I think Confederate statues put up during the 1960s in defiance of Brown v. Board of Education and in defiance of the Civil Rights Act should come down probably. But I'm not sure that George Washington should come down. I mean, if you look at the whole man theory of these people, they're much more interesting than just the thing for which they're now being condemned. So I do think this requires the humanities, Doug. We need philosophers, historians, art historians, people of the oppressed races that are affected by this. We need social planners, city planners, landscape architects. We need to gather people together and have everyone at the table and have serious, sometimes quarrelsome debates about these things and then make careful adjustments. But I would be very sorry if we pluck down everything that this generation suddenly finds objectionable, because the next generation may have a different view of what to celebrate in public art. And I think it's a dangerous game when it slides away from deliberation towards mob action.
Well, you mentioned the Andrew Jackson statue in Lafayette Park, and that's symbolic of something. And so yes, was the president when Donald Trump was honoring, I believe, a couple of Native Americans, famously had them posed as during the ceremony under the portrait of Andrew Jackson, the architect of the Trail of Tears.
Yes, and that really troubles me. You know, Andrew Jackson is the current president's favorite former president. And Andrew Jackson was the Trail of Tears. He slaughtered Native peoples in the Floridas, in Florida and the Gulf states. He was a dualist. He was a man of anger. He was a populist, sort of in the tradition of Donald Trump. He's not one of my favorite presidents. But you know what? He was the president of the United States. And he did some things that are really important. He was the first of the presidents who had great popular support. You know, the previous presidents, John Adams and Jefferson and Washington, were part of the establishment elite, and they really were governing on behalf of the American people, but not really of or from the ranks of the American people. And Jackson was a Democrat with a really strong commitment to populist sovereignty. And so we need that, too. I think that has to be factored in. And I would probably remove Andrew Jackson from Lafayette Square, but only after proper and careful debate and deliberation. But it's easy for me to say that, isn't it, Doug? Because I'm a white man who lives in faraway North Dakota, has been privileged all of his life to earn his living by reading books and talking like this. Easy for me to say these things because I've never been oppressed. I've never felt that if I were walking in a street late at night, I might be shot dead by white vigilantes, or if the police stopped me on a routine traffic check, it might end my life. It's easy for me to talk about deliberation and that we should all contextualize these monuments, but I am not one of those people who has been damaged by the lingering inequities and systemic racism of the country. And so it seems to me that people like you and I need to do more listening and less asserting in questions like this, that it's not really for us to make these determinations, although we probably should be somewhere at the table.
Well, we're all very complicated people, and those people we're talking about, Jefferson and Washington and Jackson, were in themselves complex human beings. And the thing that I'm kind of marveling at right now is how Black Lives Matter, which was a phrase that was considered somewhat provocatively divisive not so long ago, is now mainstream.
Yes, it's mainstreaming, and that too can be dangerous. You know, I think the way in which people are just sort of signing onto this as a new brand or as a convenient way to show that they're enlightened is something that we need to think about. And I also think there's been sort of woke shaming, you know, people rushing to be the most righteous, the most enlightened. I've heard, you know, thoughts that maybe Lake Agassiz can no longer be called Agassiz because of Agassiz's race views and so on. It seems to me that we're really moving into dangerous ground if we if we all rush to try to be super enlightened and not to really investigate these questions. And I also think, I mean, I don't want to complicate this much further, but when I drive around in Montana and Wyoming, I see all these places named after Custer. And it always rubs me the wrong way. I'm not really a fan of Custer. But Custer was a man of his time. He was doing work on behalf of the United States government. He was an Army officer. He also had considerable sympathy with Native Americans. And he said in his book, My Life on the Plains, that if he were a Native American, he would be like Crazy Horse and Red Cloud and the wild recalcitrants, knowing freedom in the fullest possible sense on horseback on the plains. But when I drive past these places like Custer State Park in South Dakota, I'm glad they're named Custer. I wouldn't change that to, you know, Nice Tree State Park or Beautiful Pine State Park, because every time I drive by, it makes me think about this. It makes me ask myself questions about, well, what did Custer represent in 1870? What does he now represent in 2020? How did we get from there to here? Are we right and they wrong? Are we the beneficiaries, living in the Dakotas, of the work that the government did to subjugate Native Americans? We are, in some sense, the beneficiaries of that very conquest of the West that we find it so easy to decry from our colleges and from our foundations and our state councils for the humanities and National Public Radio. You know, I guess if I were going to march in a protest, and I marched in one 3 weeks ago here in Bismarck, the sign I would carry is, I am complicit. We are all complicit.
So much in our world has become uncertain.
That's why we make it our business to bring you the news in the way you expect it.
When we need to, we adjust our coverage, knowing you're adjusting along with us.
And using what you learn to keep yourself and your families safe.
We keep you caught up on the latest news when the only thing certain is change.
We make Morning Edition.
We make All Things Considered.
We make NPR for you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Tri-Valley Opportunity Council, offering the Foster Grandparent Program, a volunteer opportunity for older adults to assist kids with exceptional or special needs to be more successful in school. Volunteers are needed. Learn more at tvoc.org.
And by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and I'm joined by Clay Jenkinson, humanities scholar well-known across North Dakota and a frequent visitor to our show, and also the author of two books, but we're talking about the second one now, Bring Out Your Dead, The Literature and History of Epidemics. You're the author of many books, Clay. I don't know how many, but two just recently. So why did you write this book?
I should just say as we go that this is the year of four books. So we talked about Repairing Jefferson's America, and now we're talking about Bring Out Your Dead. I also had a book published in February from University of Nebraska Press called Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena, based on one of the great symposia that we held out at Dickinson State University. And then my big book on North Dakota is coming out at the end of the year or early next year. I've been working on this for 2 years, Doug, and I'm kind of afraid to push send. It's a careful, candid exploration of North Dakota's identity and our identity problem as we move from an agrarian place into whatever it is we're going to become next. And so the year of four books, and plus I have a comedy album out called Talking Out of Tights. You can get it on iTunes. So I've been busy. I've been a busy little humanist out here in the pandemic. Nothing else to do except take long walks in the evening, like Candide, nurse my garden, and then write. But this other book, Bring Out Your Dead, I wrote in the last 6 weeks, and here's why. I'm teaching an online course, Pandemics in Literature and History, and we looked at great classics of epidemics. And the minute, it's like a new vocabulary word, Doug. The minute you start looking for pandemics in literature, they're everywhere. The Iliad by Homer starts with an epidemic. Oedipus Rex begins with an epidemic. Of course, there are the epidemics of the first books of the Jewish and Christian Bible. Then you have Thucydides, the history of the Peloponnesian War. Athens went through a terrible epidemic in the midst of its struggle against Sparta, and on and on and on. So we read classics in this form from Defoe's A Journal of the Plague Year, which was published in 1721. Defoe is the same one who wrote Robinson Crusoe. And going all the way to Camus, Albert Camus, who wrote The Plague in the 1940s. And then the final book in that course was The Stand by Stephen King, an immense novel about a pandemic that kills off 95% of all the people on Earth. So the course was about that, and I wrote a lot of essays about the history of pandemics, thinking that if I tried to put our current situation in the context of history and literature, that it would make more sense. But here's what I learned, Doug. Humans never learn. The same thing happened in Athens as happened in London in 1665, as happened in Camus, the plague, as happens now, or the Spanish flu of 1918, and now with this pandemic. Humans start by being in denial. The government usually covers it up. The newspapers are reluctant to report the worst of the news. Suddenly, everyone wakes up one morning and realizes they're in a terrible cataclysm. People scramble. The rich leave. The poor have to stay. The poor wind up serving the wealthier people in ways that put the poor at great personal health risk. And then when we think we have the pandemic under control, we rush back into the public square much too soon and thus create a second and third wave. And in the case of the Spanish flu, the second wave was infinitely worse than the first. And this pattern, which you could learn from if you really wanted to, continues every time. And what's happened since, say, January 1st, 2020, has followed every piece of the standard formula of how a civilization fails to do the right thing soon enough to prevent the thing from getting out of hand.
Well, we have the same arguments that were taking place 100 years ago during the flu epidemic, and that is whether or not people should wear masks, whether or not businesses should close, and when those things aren't done, the inevitable happens, because viruses are things that look for people. And if people get together, viruses do too.
Yeah, it's the politicization and the paralysis that we were talking about earlier with respect to Jefferson. So now wearing a mask is a political act. And interestingly, I was in Oregon to do a documentary film shoot, and I went to the Portland International Airport yesterday, and 98% of all people in that airport were wearing masks. Then I flew to Denver and spent 2 hours at Denver International, where about 80% of all people were wearing masks. And then I flew to Bismarck, where about 5% of people were wearing masks. And I thought, huh, red state, the idea that wearing a mask somehow makes you synonymous with liberal, coward, overly compliant, leftist, anti-Trump, and that refusing to wear a mask makes you an exemplar of human liberty is just nonsense. This is a public health thing. It has nothing to do with politics. The pandemic doesn't understand red versus blue, Trump versus Pelosi. And yet this has become this crazy thing in which rational or seemingly rational human beings refuse to wear a mask when we know that the number one thing you can possibly do until a vaccine is in place is social distancing and mask wearing. And yet you look at the results, and when I look at my fellow North Dakotans, whom I love, and see that they are swept up in the cult of this president who, in defiance of public health, refuses to show what the country should be doing in a situation like this, that just breaks my heart, because I know we're better than that. And I don't blame the people of North Dakota for this, because it's part of whatever is happening to the culture that has divided us into this cold civil war. But I certainly would rather be in the Portland International Airport at a time like this than in Bismarck or Fargo.
Well, there are other implications to this kind of public awareness, I guess, of our fragility. There are lots of books, lots of articles being published right now about pandemics and epidemics, and I came across one that was, I thought, rather interesting. It's from Frank M. Snowden, Epidemics in Society from the Black Death to the Present, and that was published this year as well. And he says this: cholera and tuberculosis in today's world move along the fault lines created by poverty and inequality and the way in which, as a people, we seem to be prepared to accept that as somehow right and proper, or at least inevitable. And when you look at the people who are falling to the pandemic, initially, minority people, typically, older people, like me, the more vulnerable because of underlying health conditions, poverty is reflected in that. there are all kinds of long simmering issues that have been revealed. The scabs have been picked at by this pandemic.
Yes, absolutely. The race element is an important one, and also the question of poverty. And, you know, in Defoe's A Journal of the Plague Year, which was 1721, he says that the poor wind up doing heroic things for the privileged classes. The privileged won't go get their own food, so poor people do it for them.
They're the essential workers. They're the essential
people. The essential workers continue to do their work heroically. They know the risks they're taking, but they do it. African Americans played a huge role in the 1793 yellow fever outbreak in Philadelphia. It was thought that they were less susceptible to yellow fever than their white counterparts. Absolutely untrue. The death rate was identical. But they heroically served as nurses and provided food and got firewood and coal for the privileged classes and died in the same percentage as those that had fled and refused to be engaged in that kind of work. So class and poverty are important measures of this. Race is an important measure of this. And now you see, whatever you think of the Affordable Health Care Act, Obamacare, the idea of filing a lawsuit to remove 23 million people from the healthcare rolls in the midst of this global pandemic just seems to me so counter-rational. And if we're going to get rid of Obamacare, let's do it a year from now or 2 years from now. We're in the middle of this extraordinary global catastrophe, and the idea of suddenly pulling the plug for health access to 23 million Americans because we don't like the politics of the Affordable Care Act appears little short of cruel and inhuman to me, but there is where we are. And so this book that I've written is by the way, is not pessimistic. It's really an attempt to place all of this in the wider context of the humanities, which is the world to which I've given my life. And the second half of the book is much more fun. It's called The Joy of Reading in an Age of Distraction, and it's about how much reading we're all getting done now and how much fun that is and what reading really is and what do we learn from reading. And there's a chapter on dictionaries. There's a chapter on people who refuse to mark up their books and people who mark them up in a really vicious way and so on. So it's kind of a book about a lot of things, but it's about sort of a coping mechanism. It's almost a how-to book. How do you get through a pandemic and not panic?
The book is Bring Out Your Dead, The Literature and History of Epidemics. This is Clay Jenkinson, who's the author of this and many other books. And Clay, what about the influence of something like a pandemic and its effect on spirituality and religion and, our thoughts about God and all of that?
Well, I can take you all the way back to Thucydides, who wrote the history of the Peloponnesian War in the 5th century BCE. And he said after a certain amount of time, the Athenians stopped believing in their gods because the gods couldn't protect them from the pandemic. And we see the same thing in Camus' La Peste, or the plague written in the 1940s, that at a certain point, organized Christianity has no answer. Why would God do this? Is God punishing us? Is it random? If we pray, will God step in and help us? These are hard, hard questions, and a pandemic or a giant earthquake or a tsunami, these always raise this set of questions. So people need religion, we know that, in various forms. I take my religion mostly out in the Badlands. Other peoples take their religion in a Lutheran church. But the question is, what's God up to? Is he standing with his arms folded while this happens? Is this a purely human thing? What are the spiritual opportunities that this pandemic gives us to rethink our lives? And I think this is an opportunity. In other words, I don't think you can pray to God and he'll stop the epidemic. I think, however, if you open your being to a spiritual journey right now, that it will pay off in an important way for the way you live the rest of your life, whether it's 2 years or 60 years.
We've had epidemics that are just quirks of fate and humankind being snug with each other. And we've also had epidemics that have been imposed. And I'm thinking of the purposeful infection, particularly by smallpox-infested blankets of Native Americans as we were moving across the West.
Yeah, the worst of these was not necessarily germ warfare, but in 1837, the steamboat St. Peter's was coming from St. Louis in its annual run of trade goods up to the upper Missouri, to the Mandan, the Hidatsa, the Arikara, the Dakota, the Lakota, the Crow, and so on. And smallpox got on board that steamboat at Sioux City, and they knew it. And they didn't quarantine, they didn't stop the boat, they just kept on going, hoping that they could bring the trade goods to Fort Union and Fort Clark and so on, and not have tight contact between Native peoples and the crew of the boat. And of course that didn't happen. And among the Mandan, 90% of all the Mandan people died in the epidemic. This wasn't done on purpose, but it was done with some indifference, with some negligence, with insufficient commitment to public health amongst the Native people. And when you read this story, it's our story. This is about North Dakota in 1837, and when you read this story, it just breaks your heart.
Isn't the threat of a pandemic and the reality of one a strong argument for universal health care?
Of course. You know, when this started, I thought, well, what good is going to come of this? You know, what good will come of this? I think wearing masks on airplanes is a good idea. I've seen Asians traveling all over the world wearing masks, and I've always been a little bit sarcastic about that. I never will be again. That's one thing. Practicing better hygiene. You know, now when I'm in a men's room at the airport and someone isn't going to wash his hands, I say, hey, wash your hands. And I feel like I can now. But I've wanted to say that for decades. You know, just don't want to get killed in that bathroom. And I thought, certainly this will lead to two things. This will lead to universal health care, whether it's Medicare for all or whatever hybrid system we produce, because you just have to face that everyone is susceptible and you can't have a system that delivers different levels of health care and different access to health care based upon your ethnicity or your income or your zip code. So I thought that this would certainly lead to universal health care. And the other thing I thought was, you know, given the financial bailouts of several trillion dollars, I thought this will lead to what's been in the air anyway, a guaranteed minimal income. As we move into artificial intelligence and greater robotics, there are going to be millions and millions of people in America who can't work, who can't find work no matter how able they are. And we're going to have to figure out how people are going to feed themselves, because if they can't feed themselves, if they can't work, they're going to commit crimes. You know, people refuse to just starve to death. And so we have to figure out what the future of this economy is going to look like. As you know, the first fully robotic farm is going to be in place in Cass County here shortly. We aren't going to need as many farmers, as many citizens, as many towns as we have in North Dakota. So if we're going to remain a place to live in, we're going to have to find out what the economy is going to look like in a post-carbon era, and we're heading towards that, whether we like it or not, and a post-family farm era. And these people, like Andrew Yang, who are talking about some sort of guaranteed minimal family income just to preserve social stability, it seems to me that the time has come to talk about that, because that's what's kept so many of your listeners afloat. You know, people who work in the service industries and restaurants, who have small businesses. If we hadn't had this government largesse, and it's not nearly enough, and we need to renew it, but if we hadn't had that, imagine the social instability, even in a peaceful, lovely place like North Dakota. So, yes, it's time for universal health care. I don't think we're going to get it, but I think until we solve that problem, we're going to have continuing basic social problems in the United States.
Well, I've just got a couple of minutes left, but I want to leave with one more Lollapalooza, I guess, if you will, and that is, how do we deal with the reality of demagoguery, the kind of government that governs by bumper sticker, slogan, yeah, belittling, versus science, which is clear and always discovering new things and learning better ways to do things?
Well, you've raised a question that could lead to several hours of conversation and debate, but my other book, Repairing Jefferson's America, has some thoughts about that. We need to take a deep breath. We need to listen to each other. We need to respect each other's point of view, even when we disagree with it. We need to stop living by soundbite and bumper sticker and meme and trope on Facebook and other social media. We need to investigate more and react in a knee-jerk way less. And I mean that for both sides of this debate. I think there's terrible abuse on both ends of the political spectrum. So we're going to have to restore civility, you know, and Voltaire you know, is said to have said, "Madam, I disagree with what you say, but I shall defend to the death your right to say it." You know, the liberals can't be belittling the conservatives all the time, as they have done, and because of that have elected President Trump. And the conservatives can't be beating up on the liberals all the time and calling them communists and Marxists and all the things that we're seeing. We have to bring down the temperature, and we need to listen to each other, and we need to talk with mutual respect. I try always to really respect the other point of view. You can't always do it because we're all frail. But whenever I do it, I'm happy and things get better. But whenever you're righteous, I think righteousness in all of its forms is a terrible problem for all of us. Whenever you're righteous, you sort of end debate rather than open it up. And so I think so well of the people of North Dakota, and I want them to kind of sober up from this anger that they have felt for the last 20 or so years and realize we've never had it so good, Doug. I mean, North Dakota has never been as prosperous, as free, as mobile, as well-kempt as it currently is. We need to cheer up about life. We don't have any particular enemies, and certainly not within the borders of the United States. But, you know, easy to say these things, harder to accomplish them.
Clay Jenkinson, humanities scholar, author. We've been talking about two books, Repairing Jefferson's America and Bring Out Your Dead. It's always a pleasure, Clay. I look forward to talking about the next book.
Let me just quickly say this. This is why we need public radio, because if this were commercial television or radio, you would have said, well, in 2 minutes, tell me the point of your book. It wasn't Jefferson just a floppy racist, and that would be the end of the segment. We need longer form, real conversations, and I so respect and appreciate all that you do there.
Before highways, there were trails, and the Red Trail is North Dakota's original auto trail. When you drive the old Red Old 10 scenic byway between Mandan and Dickinson, you will enjoy fascinating countryside and meet friendly folks. Load up the family in your car and experience a legendary journey on the old Red Old 10. More information at the Old Red Old 10 Facebook page or online at oldredold10.com.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.